I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. More than 60 years ago, Edith Piaf recorded her most famous song, Je ne regrette rien. I regret nothing. Daniel Pink writes in his new book, The Power of Regret, that Piaf might have had a happier, easier life if she had regretted something. He says there's a no-regrets attitude, a kind of philosophy that's very popular in the country today. It says focusing on regrets is a waste of time, a sign of weakness, and makes us feel bad about ourselves. So forget about the past and live in the present. Daniel Pink wants us to reclaim regret, which is a universal emotion about wishing we had done something differently. All those nagging feelings of, if only. He says by acknowledging our failings and missed opportunities, we can live a fuller and better life. His book is based in part on regret surveys and what they reveal about the impact of regret in people's lives. Daniel Pink, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me back.
Well, true confessions time. I will confess my regret, and then you can do yours. Mine goes back to ninth grade, and I was part of a little mean girl gang. And we used to do kind of playful, jokey, kind of misdemeanors. And it took a really nasty turn, and we started to pick on this young girl, a ninth grader. We made her feel bad about herself. We turned her into an outcast. And I have to say, this is decades ago, and to this day, I feel so badly about what we did to her and so regretful about the kind of misery that we put her through.
Well, you're not alone. No. That's a fairly common regret that people have. I was astonished when I collected regrets around the world how many people regretted bullying. But I think this, in some ways, Marty, tells us why regret is important, because the fact that you remember it so many years later, decades later, is clarifying. It actually helps you understand what you value, and it's a reminder to you that you actually value kindness. And it also is an instruction. It instructs you what to do in the future. And this is the power of regret. Sometimes with our regrets, we want to ignore them. Say, it happened in the past, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Other times you can conclude from that, you know, a story like yours, oh my gosh, I am the worst person in the world. I'm just a horrible, flawed human being. That's a bad idea too. What we want to do is think about our regrets and use them to clarify and instruct us.
You call that a moral regret. What's yours? What's a regret that has really nagged you for years?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Marty, because one of the ones that's nagged me for years is sort of a sibling or a first cousin of that. And it has to do with when I was younger. And it has to do with kindness. I was never like a mean guy. I was never a bully or anything like that. But here's the thing, and in some ways it's even worse. I was in many situations where people were being maybe treated the way that the person that you're describing there was. Or people, I remember situations when I was in school, when I was in college, when I was a young professional, of people being excluded, of being left out, of being not treated as equals, not being treated fairly by other people. And I didn't affirmatively exclude them. But I was there, and I saw it going on and didn't do a damn thing. Mm-hmm. And it really bugs me. Even to this day, it bugs me. But again, it's how I use that negative emotion. And again, like yours, it's clarifying for me. It actually helped me understand that I value kindness more than I might have realized. And it's actually helped me in small ways, even in like social gatherings now. I actually go out of my way to, if someone is sort of marooned by themselves at a social gathering, I will bring them into the scrum if I happen to be in a scrum, or will reach out to somebody who isn't talking to anybody because of that spear of pain that I have from years ago.
Help us understand, though, as you write, there is a kind, I wasn't frankly aware of this, but a kind of no regrets philosophy. You said at the Library of Congress there's something like 50 books with the title using the word no regrets in it. You quote a lot of people that say, no regrets, you know, I'm moving on, I'm living in the present. Where did that come from?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I think it comes largely from, in some ways, good intentions. And it comes in part from the positive psychology, not the positive psychology movement, but the positive thinking movement of the 1950s and 60s, where Norman Vincent Peale and others talked about the power of positive thinking. And the truth is that positive emotions are really good. Like, I want positive emotions. Sure. I want other people to have positive emotions. We should have positive emotions. But the idea that a life well lived is full of only positive emotions is foolish. It goes against the science, and it's actually an ineffective. It's an ineffective way to live. So at some level, it's too much of a good thing. And I think the other part of that is that we haven't been taught how to deal with negative emotions. And so the way we're taught to deal with negative emotions is often to ignore them. And when that doesn't happen, when we can't do that fully, we end up getting captured by them and wallowing in them and ruminating in them. And what we need is a better approach, I think, in general in our lives toward dealing with negative emotions.
I mean, it's hard because they're painful. Do you see a connection between regret and things like shame and guilt? Do you see them as interconnected emotions or feelings?
Well, it's a really interesting question too. You know, to me, guilt is to me a component of regret. Guilt is usually things that we've done, and actually, the majority of regrets that people express are things they haven't done. They're inactions, and guilt has a moral component to it. It's like I've done something to breach some kind of moral duty. Shame is more complicated. There's not a lot of good in shame. guilt is essentially I did a bad thing, and shame is essentially I'm a bad person, and so shame is much more debilitating. Shame is an assessment of your total self rather than an assessment of your action.
You looked at or used actually a couple of different surveys, an American survey, a world survey, looking at the things that people regret. Were there universals? I mean, things that crossed all, you know, country boundaries, age boundaries, race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality that struck you?
There was surprising universality. And in fact, there was a surprising lack of demographic difference. So I did one study where I did basically a large public opinion survey of U.S. attitudes about regret and configured a sample large enough so I could make claims about were there differences in gender or race or anything like that. And there weren't that many, to my surprise. There was a big difference in age. That was the biggest difference, that when we're young, we tend to have equal numbers of regrets of action and inaction. That is, in our 20s, we have roughly equal numbers of regrets about things we did and things we didn't do. But as we age, the inaction regrets take over. In our 40s, 50s, and 60s, so it's 2-to-1 inaction regrets over action regrets.
Is that because we're at a certain age where, you know, we realize we've lived the majority of our life and we have a tendency to look back on our life and think more philosophically?
Possibly. I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is that it's possible to resolve certain kinds of action regrets. So you could go back and track down that person who you mistreated and apologize to her. You can, you know, I have people who believe in the no regrets philosophy so deeply that they have tattoos that say that. But I have one guy who got a no regrets tattoo and then realized he had regrets and had it removed. So, you know,
his no regrets tattoo. Right.
So you can undo that. He had it, and you can also find silver linings, which is psychologically healthy. You can say a lot of people in the database of world regrets saying, I regret marrying that idiot, but at least I have these two great kids. Yeah. With inaction regrets, they nag at us. They, as Ogden Nash, the poet, said, they lay eggs under our skin. They nag at us because they're harder to resolve, and they end up revealing things that are more important to us. Things like the desire to be bold and to do things that are meaningful, the desire to connect with people we love. And those kinds of things that are integrally important in a life well lived.
You mentioned the words "I'm sorry," and I guess that's also a difficult thing to say sometimes. That the sort of "I'm sorry" part of regret is also it's a way out of it, but it's a way of acknowledging the thing that we did that we do actually regret.
For actions, absolutely. And what I have found, and there's some good research on this, is that the people who have been aggrieved, to whom you apologize, they tend to be very forgiving, much more forgiving than we think. I've heard many stories about people who, especially let's go back to bullying, people who have been on the receiving end of bullying and have actually had their bullies reach out to them after two decades, three decades, and the bullies are actually in many ways more troubled than the recipients of the bullying. And most of the people who are recipients of the bullying are willing to forgive and exonerate the other person.
Do you have to have a heart, though, to be able to do that? I mean, we all, you know, there are psychopaths in the world that do terrible things and have absolutely no regrets. And I'm not going to name names because I think we know who we're talking about.
But the thing is, that's actually a really, really important point that you're making there, which is that the people who don't when you don't have regrets, when you truly don't have regrets, that's the sign of a problem. Okay, so that's a sign you could be a sociopath. All right, it's also there also are brain injuries and brain diseases that interrupt with our inability to experience regret. So certain kinds of lesions in the part of the brain called the orbital frontal cortex, people with those kinds of lesions often can't experience regret. People who certain kinds of Huntington's disease and certain kinds of Parkinson's disease can't experience regret. Little kids, five-year-olds, can't experience regret because their brains haven't developed the dexterity that regret requires. And so one of the things to keep in mind here is how integral regret is to a functioning brain. Regret is an essential emotion. It's part of our cognitive machinery. And so denying that is denying a part of how we think and how we can flourish.
And what part of our brain? Do we know where regret resides?
Well, I don't. I think it's more complicated. We don't know. What we do know is that these lesions in this certain part of our brain, sort of this part of the brain that's in the front called the orbital frontal cortex, seems to disrupt that. But I think that for most emotions and for most sensations, most cognitive processes, it's more complicated. Things usually are not located in one place. It's
right.
More of a spread out more network in that. So all we know is from the reverse is that lesions in this one part seem to interrupt our ability to experience regret.
Having written a book about regret, do you do a better job of either doing things that you don't have to regret or expressing regret when you do the things that you wish you hadn't?
I think so. I mean, a reason that I wrote this book is that I had regrets of my own and I wanted to reckon with them. I mean, there's an old line in social science that all research is me-search. And that was certainly the case for writing a book about regret. I also think, to one of your earlier points, Marty, that this is not a book I would have written in my 30s. I don't think I had enough mileage on me. But in my 50s, it felt kind of inevitable because I had room to look back and I hope I have room to look forward. And when I dove into the science, I realized that we had mischaracterized this emotion. This emotion does not make us weak. This emotion can make us strong if we deal with it right. And that's the key. We haven't been taught how to deal with it properly.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Daniel Pink. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. We'll be talking about the sort of four core regrets and also take your calls and comments. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Daniel Pink about regret. His new book is titled The Power of Regret. Daniel, let's talk about the four core regrets, as you mentioned. I talked about being a mean girl in high school as a kind of, and you say that's really a moral regret where it's about your core and really being like the person you don't want to be.
Right. It's even more simply than that. It's doing the wrong thing.
Right.
Moral regrets are if only I'd done the right thing. You know, a lot of these regrets begin at a juncture. And in this particular kind of regret, you begin at a juncture. You can do the right thing. You can do the wrong thing. And when we do the wrong thing, as you've done, as I've done, many of us, I mean, the vast, vast majority of us regret it because I think fundamentally most of us want to be good.
There's foundation. What kind of regret is that?
So the foundation regrets are regrets that sound like this: if only I'd done the work. And these are regrets about people who, these are regrets of people who didn't work hard enough in school, people who, a lot of regrets about saving too little and spending too much. Certain, outside of the U.S., a lot of regrets about smoking. So it's small decisions early in our life that accumulate into bad consequences later in our life.
And boldness, that's another kind of core regret. How does
boldness is a big category of regrets. And one of the things that I discovered in looking at these, you know, we're now up to over 19,000 regrets from 109 countries, is how much these regrets transcend the typical categories that we use. So we tend to think, oh, I have a regret about my career. I have a regret about my finances. I have a regret about my education or my romance. These core regrets transcend those domains. Let me tell you what I mean by that. So I have a lot of regrets, huge numbers, that basically have the same formulation. They say, X years ago, there was a man/woman who I really liked. I wanted to ask him or her out on a date, but I didn't because I was too chicken, and I've regretted it ever since. So that's a romance regret. You have other regrets, you know, not as severe, of people who in America, American college graduates who regret not studying abroad. Is to me, I was blown away by how much of a regret that is among Americans who graduated from college. So that's an education regret. Oh, I didn't study abroad. I should have taken that chance. Then you have a lot of regrets of people who stayed in lackluster jobs when they say, oh, what I really wanted to do was start my own business, go out on my own, be more entrepreneurial. That's a career regret. But all those regrets are the same. Those are the regrets that say, if only I'd taken a chance. Once again, you're at a juncture. You can play it safe or you can take the chance. And to my surprise, people really regretted not taking the chance. Hmm. And even people who took a chance and it flopped are surprisingly less agonized. It's really that desire to just step up and do something that I think really nags at people when they don't do it.
Let me read a couple of quotes from your book. This is a male, age 23, from California. When I was 13, I quit the saxophone because I thought it was too uncool to keep playing. 10 years later, I realized how wrong I was with that assessment. Male, 68, Virginia, thinking that working 18 hours a day, 6 days a week when I first started out would help me be successful. Instead, I destroyed my marriage and almost my health. Those are, you know, that last one in particular is a really powerful regret.
Oh, we have so, I mean, what's amazing about these regrets, Marty, that, you know, that, and your listeners can get them at, can see a huge sample of them at worldregretsurvey.com. You can even go on our interactive map when it's working properly and look by country or by state or Canadian province. These are little mini sagas about people's lives. And what I found is that people really want to talk about these kinds of things. They want to disclose, they want to tell the stories about things that they regret, because that helps them make sense of it and helps them do better in the future.
And the other regret that we haven't talked about is core regret that you define as connection. And that's really, I guess, what the most common regret that you saw?
Yeah. And these connection regrets are about relationships, and it's not romantic. It's some romantic relationships, but it's mostly not romantic relationships. It's other relationships. It's relationships with our parents or our kids or our siblings or other relatives. Oh my gosh, with our friends. And what happens in these connection regrets is that you have a relationship that was intact or that should have been intact, and it comes apart. And what intrigued me about this is that when you hear the stories of how these relationships come apart, most of them are profoundly undramatic. Wow. Like there's no screaming. There's some, you know, every once in a while there's like deep estrangement and throwing plates and so forth. But in many of them, they just kind of drift apart. And what happens is that one person wants to reach out and they say, oh, it's going to be really awkward if I reach out. And besides, the other side's not going to care. So things drift apart even further. And in many cases, it's too late. So connection regrets are, if only I'd reached out.
Well, let me read another one. This is from a 54-year-old woman. And she shared, as you write, she shared this. And I kept reading this. I regret not being nicer to my mom. I took her for granted when I was younger, thinking that I was so much smarter than she was. Typical teenager, she says. When I grew up, we argued over politics, both of us passionate about our viewpoints. Now that she's gone, I miss her desperately so much that it takes my breath away sometimes. I did the daughter thing all wrong. Yeah. I look at my daughters and pray that they are kinder to me than I was to my own mom, even though I'm not sure I deserve it. I mean, yeah. She is saying a lot there.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's the emotion packed into that one regret is really extraordinary. And in that case, I think that's a case of what I like to call a closed door regret, where she has regrets about her connections to her mother, but her mother is gone and she can't do anything about it. And those are really painful. There's someone whose story I tell in the book who had a friend who had childhood friend who had cancer. She wanted to reach out to her. She kept putting it off because she thought it was going to be awkward. She kept putting it off. And then finally, when she did call her friend had died literally that morning.
Oh, gosh.
And so these are the kinds of things that, but here's the thing, there are lessons in all of these. And to me, these connection regrets, which are you know, so emotional and so palpably human, is that for me personally, just, you know, I'll just say for myself, it changed these connection regrets, reading these changed me in that I realized for myself, if I'm at a juncture where I'm wondering, should I reach out or should I not reach out? I've answered the question.
Right.
You reach out.
Right.
And what's happened is that we make some cognitive errors here when we decide that we don't want to reach out, because people say it's going to be awkward and the other side's not going to care. And when they actually reach out, here's what happens. It's not very awkward, and the other side always cares.
guaranteed?
Not guaranteed, but 9 times out of 10. And what's more is that if the other side says screw you, then you know that's fine. You have some finality to it. But they don't say that. People don't extrapolate enough from their own experience. So if you have I talked to somebody who was agonized over this friendship, college friendship that had come apart. Again, very slowly, undramatically, and she wanted to reach out to her old friend, and she said, "Oh no, it's going to be so creepy. It's going to be creepy. She's going to think it's creepy." And I finally said to her, "Cheryl, like, what if this woman Jen reached out to you?" And Cheryl said, "Oh my God, Dan, that would be the greatest thing." And I'm like, "Well, you know, you're not that special. Think of, you know, extrapolate from your own experience."
Let me read one more, and then I want to make sure our listeners can join our conversation. This is also this connection regret, a person saying, "I regret not taking advantage of spending time with my grandparents as a child. I resented their presence in my home and their desire to connect with me, and now I do anything to get that time back." So how do you get that time back with someone who is, you know, no longer with us? How do you fix that?
On that one, you can't. Okay. Right. And so that's a closed door. But that particular person, she did something very intriguing. So this is very intriguing and also instructive for the rest of us. So that's a person named Abby. She's about 30 years old now, who lives in Arizona. And so she had these grandparents who lived in Indiana, but they would come sometimes for a couple of months to stay at her parents' home in Indiana when she was a little kid, and she resented it. She didn't like it. Then she realized that she missed out on all their stories, and she can't do anything about that. But what she's done is she's taken this newly systematic approach to her own parents, collecting their stories, actually subscribing to a service that gathers their stories and asking them about the stories of their lives and compiling the stories of their lives, because she's using this negative emotion of regret, "Oh my God, I totally blew it," as a clarifier, "Wow, I actually value connection to my family." And as instruction, "I don't want to blow it again, so I'm going to be much more affirmative in making sure that I hear from my parents, understand their lives, and collect their stories."
Again, that's Daniel Pink, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And again, you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. We all have regrets. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And I guess the question is, what do we do about them? Here's a question from Debbie. What if people have too many regrets? Does that come from being too self-critical? And can that be dangerous too? What do you think, Daniel Pink?
Absolutely can be dangerous, sure. One of the ways to begin to reckon with our regrets is actually, it sounds a little counterintuitive, is to be slightly less self-critical. We have a lot of good research on this. What we see is that self-esteem, okay? So, you know, I'm the greatest. I've bucked myself up on self-esteem. I'm good enough. I'm strong enough. Self-esteem is not bad, but It's overrated. It leads to all kinds of downsides like narcissism and bias against outgroups. Self-criticism is very interesting because I love self-criticism personally, except there's very little evidence that it's effective. What's effective as a starting point in reckoning with our regrets is something called self-compassion, which is an idea created by Kristen Neff at the University of Texas about 20 years ago. And it's very simple. Instead of being self-critical, you should be self-compassionate and basically treat yourself with the same kindness that you would treat somebody else. What we see is that when we talk to ourselves in the face of mistakes, we are brutal. We talk to ourselves in ways that we would never talk to another human being. If I talk to somebody else, if I were in a workplace and talked to somebody else the way I talk to myself privately, I'd be fired, all right?
I'm nodding my head vigorously, yes.
Yeah, and so Marty, it's like that old joke where a guy goes to a doctor's office and he says, "Doctor, it hurts when I do this." And the doctor says, "Don't do that." you know, instead, what you should do is treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt and recognize that your missteps are part of the human condition. You know, we sometimes over-index on how special we are, both for good and for ill. So, you know, so you at the top of the show, you said you had this regret about kindness. Whoa, I have a regret about kindness. A lot of people have regrets about kindness. It's part of the human condition. It doesn't fully define us. It's a moment in our lives. And so once we do treat ourselves with self-compassion, that can arrest the march toward rumination. That can arrest the march toward saying, oh, yeah, and I did this thing wrong, too, and I did this thing wrong, too, and I'm terrible for that reason.
Here's an email from PJ who says, my ex was an alcoholic and I raised our son as a single dad. I encouraged him not to shun her and to maintain a relationship. When she died, he expressed relief that he followed my advice because he would have regretted shunning her. The emotion he felt was sadness growing up without a loving mother. I mean, that's a very poignant story.
But it's very good parenting on this yep. part because again, I mean, whether this dad knew it or knew, I mean, I think this dad was anticipating the regrets of somebody else, and that's a very difficult thing to do. But he was right in the sense that what we know, here's the thing, we can make pretty good predictions about what each of us is going to regret in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. And one of the things is going to be estrangement or not connecting to people you love, even if they are flawed in the way that this young man's mother was.
Here's a comment from Mary. She says, I'm 80 years old. I'm still bothered by a lie I told my teacher in first grade.
Wow.
I told her that I had permission to go to the store and I didn't have permission, and it still bugs me today.
Oh.
I mean, that's like almost an entire lifetime, Mary.
Mary. You're not alone. I mean, just treat like on that one. So first of all, I think that regret speaks well of you because what it says to me is that you're a person who believes in telling the truth. You're a person who believes in keeping your word. You're a person who wants to be trusted. And my guess is that that moment, my gosh, when you were six, might have actually helped guide you to a moral life today. On that one, at age 80, for something when you were six. I have to say, you know,
time to forgive yourself.
Try to be a good person the rest of your life, but but on that one, you're not alone. Treat yourself with some compassion. You might on that one want to let yourself off the hook.
What about patterns of regret? I mean, maybe it's, you know, the choice not taken, or, you know, whether, you know, you're just sort of relentlessly mean to people. That would be sort of in a whole other category. But when you look back in your life and you say, you know, I there's so many things I didn't do that I wished I had done. What do we do with that pattern of regret?
Well, it's an interesting question. It depends on what kind of pattern it is. So you know, one of the things that you see is so one of the small demographic differences in the American Regret Project, which is a giant public opinion survey that I did, which is kind of intriguing in this regard, is that people with higher degrees, higher levels of formal education, that is, you know, advanced degrees and whatnot, they actually had more career regrets than people with less formal education, which seems like a peculiar, but I think it's because if you have more education, you actually have more opportunities, and therefore possibly more opportunities foregone. And so we can spin ourselves into an abyss by recognizing that there might be endless opportunities. The number of things we didn't do is infinite. What we have to do is you have to think about which of the things we didn't do actually matters. Now, you can find patterns. I'll give you one practical idea here, sure. which I've done professionally, is something called a failure resume. It's an idea from Tina Seelig at Stanford University. And I've done this myself. I'm not sharing it, and it's sort of embarrassing, but it's useful. So what you do is you list all of your failures, your missteps, your screw-ups, your blunders in one column. And then in the next column, you list what lesson you learned from it. And then in the third column, you list what you're going to do about it. And what I found, to your point about patterns, is that when I started listing my mistakes, my screw-ups, and so forth, in some cases, there wasn't a lesson. It was just like things didn't work out. There's bad luck, circumstance. And that's actually kind of a relief. But on other ones, there was a pattern. And for me, a lot of these mistakes, I was making the same two mistakes over and over again. And so by excavating our regrets and really examining them, almost in a scientific way, we can find underlying patterns in what we're doing wrong. And for me, there were two big mistakes that I was making over and over and over and over.
And you're not going to share them with us?
Oh, I'll share those. Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
In 30 seconds or less, if you could.
I got into situations, jobs, and whatever without doing enough due diligence and research and thinking that I knew what it was going to be like when I actually had no idea. And then the second one was committing myself to agreeing to do projects where I wasn't fully committed, where I was sort of half-hearted about it. And as a consequence, things went south.
Interesting. And that was from a failure resume. And that's our guest, Daniel Pink. We are talking about regrets. He's got a brand new book. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about our regrets. How owning them can help us live a better, fuller life. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Everyone has experienced a feeling of regret, whether it's an awkward interaction or perhaps it's a bad decision or a personal failing. And yet we're often told to move on. Don't look back. Don't even acknowledge some of those mistakes and regrets that we have. Our guest Daniel Pink says, no, pay attention to them. It can lead to personal growth, to better choices, better relationships, and even happier lives. Daniel, you talked about your failure resume. You also talk about regret circles. What is that?
Well, this is an interesting practice where you gather a group of people. Let's say I gather four other people, and you each talk about a regret. And so let's say I would go first. I would talk about some regret that I have. I would then try to distill a lesson from it. But, and here's the key, the other four people would help me decide what I should do about it. Hmm. And this is actually really important, that we tend to be pretty bad at solving our own problems because we're too close to them, but pretty good at solving other people's problems. And so this is a way to enlist other people to help you find the path forward from your regret. And the other thing we know about regret is that the disclosure is inherently valuable. I mean, it's not accidental it's incredible, actually, in a way. If you think about, like, 19,000 people around the world willingly disclose their regret to a complete stranger. The other thing that's sort of interesting is that we, in the World Regret Survey, I invited people to submit their regret anonymously. I just wanted to know their gender and their location and their age. But I said, if you'd like to be contacted for a follow-up interview, you can feel free to leave your email address. And we had 32% of people opted in to be interviewed.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It's incredible. I mean, it's like, not only do I want to share my regret with a complete stranger, but I want to give him my email address so he can talk to me more about it. And it shows you about disclosure. So disclosure is an unburdening, certainly. But the other thing about disclosure, which I discovered in doing some of the research on sort of the mechanics of it, is that emotions, by their very nature, are amorphous. They're blobby. They're abstract. And that's what makes positive emotions feel so good. But it's what makes negative emotions so menacing. And so when we disclose them, when we convert them into words, in spoken word or even in writing for ourselves, we transmute in a way this blobby abstraction into concrete words, and those are less fearsome. And so we defang them in some ways, and when we see them in front of us or sort of put them out with a group of people, we begin making sense of them. And once we begin making sense of them, if we do some, either enlist other people or do some things called self-distancing, we can extract lessons from them. The big problem is that no one ever teaches us how to do this kind of stuff. We basically said, oh, you should be positive all the time, negative emotions, just ignore them. Not recognizing that negative emotions are a important part of our lives and an instructive part of our lives.
And there's so much, you know, storytelling, whether it's the stories we tell ourselves or, as you mentioned, you know, in this regret circle, the stories that we would tell someone else, the story I told you and you told me about some of the regrets in our life, the power of those stories. And sometimes we rewrite them. They're not even the thing that actually happens.
That's true, because our memories are yeah, fallible and constructive. But the other thing about disclosure, which is, you know, that, again, one of the other things that we just get wrong is that we feel like when we believe that when we disclose our mistakes, our vulnerabilities, our screw-ups to other people, that people will think less of us. And we have 30 years of behavioral science showing that in general, not in every case, but in general, people think more of us, that disclosure of our vulnerabilities is a way to build affinity with other people.
Let me read some more comments. One from Judy, who has a suggestion. She says, for those who cannot fix a regret because someone has passed on, people can volunteer for senior citizens programs or nursing homes or other similar programs. Do you believe that as well, Daniel Pink?
Sure. I think it's a great idea. I mean, again, if you're nagged by how you treated somebody and you can't repair the relationship with that person, then change how you move prospectively and how you deal with all kinds of people. So I think it's a great suggestion.
Here's an email from Gabrielle. It's a little bit long, but I'll stumble through it here. This conversation made me think of a cousin that I have sort of cut ties with in some way, sort of ghosted him at the time when his politics and attitude became untenable in my life at the time. I know that I hurt his feelings and have been feeling bad about it. I was thinking about reconnecting, but every time I try working on it, I realize that I have regret about losing the connection, but I still cannot face his attitude. So I don't really want to allow that back in my life. Explaining how I feel would probably make them feel bad. I'm confused about what I should do to move forward. What do you think, Daniel Pink?
Well, I mean, I don't think you should relitigate your political disputes with your cousin, but I do think you can reach out to your cousin and say, hi, I was thinking about you. I hope you're doing well. You know, we haven't always gotten along, but I care about you as a person. And I just can't imagine, you know, again, 99 times out of 100, you're going to get a positive response from something like that.
So you don't have to fix whatever was in the past, but just to say, especially when it comes to relationships, to say you're still in my life because I still think about you.
Exactly. And here's the thing. It's hard for me to imagine anybody on the receiving end of that not being at least somewhat touched by that.
Why is that so hard?
Because we shy away from... We're bad at predicting how we're going to feel about something. Particularly, we are so over indexed on feelings of awkwardness, and there's a lot of research about this. That is, we overestimate how awkward we're going to feel. So there's some great research in workplaces where bosses were instructed to thank people more often for what they were doing on the job, and the bosses said, oh man, it's going to be really awkward, and the other people aren't going to, you know, they're going to think it's insincere. And it turned out to the bosses, oh, that wasn't awkward thanking people. And the people on the receiving end say, oh, it's so nice that she thanked me. You see it with Vanessa Bonds at Cornell has done some recent, very interesting research on compliments. We say, oh, I don't want to give somebody a compliment because they're going to think it's creepy and they're not going to care, and it's going to feel really awkward. Because we think that when we give somebody a compliment, they're going to be like figure skating judges giving us a, you know, a rating on how articulate our compliment is. When in fact, what happens is that it's not awkward to give people compliments, and people like getting compliments. There's really, I think, a broader lesson here is sort of push back against a lot of the awkwardness we feel, because we're actually overestimating how much awkwardness there really is.
I wonder, too, whether, because these are difficult emotions, whether even as young kids, we can be taught to label them, to say, I feel bad, I feel mad, I'm jealous, or, you know, finding the words, the language to be able to say something that feels painful and uncomfortable.
Oh, you're so right about that. And we're not giving people instruction on how to, we're not giving people instruction on how to do that. And certainly, you know, if you look at something like cognitive behavior therapy, everything from cognitive behavior therapy today to back thousands of years ago to Stoic philosophy, what the naming of emotions, mm-hmm. that is actually naming things and saying, this isn't me, this is an emotion that I'm having, is extremely useful. But we don't teach people how to do that. I think what's interesting is that other practices treat negative emotions in some way systematically. So if you look at religion, you know, Catholicism has confession and repentance. Judaism has, you know, a day set aside to atone, or even something that is sort of quasi-religious, quasi-secular, AA, has a set of steps that you go through. And some of those steps are when you've aggrieved other people, you go and you acknowledge it and you make amends. But more broadly, we haven't equipped people with ways to deal with negative emotions. And so too many people get debilitated by them. Yeah. And others of us don't realize how powerfully instructive they are.
We got a lot of comments here. One from a listener says, I regret that I enabled my children with money as they led their drug-filled lives. I didn't help them, something I continue to try to not beat myself up for. That is a really painful one.
Yeah, that's, yeah. You know, I think on that one, you can't undo the past, but what you can try to do is change the way that you deal with your, if you can change the way you deal with these children now, but also in other people in their lives, you know, think about what might you be doing to enable bad behavior and try to avoid that. But that's a super, that's
tough.
Terrible one.
Here's an email from Richard. If the goal of regret analysis is not to make us perfectly happy, what are the realistic goals? A more manageable life, a better life, a life more in tune with our talents?
It's a great question. I think that what we want to do is we want to actually lead a meaningful, good life. And here's where the four core regrets give us instruction. You know, these four core regrets are, to my mind, a photographic negative of the good life. When all these people around the world have told me what they regret the most, they're telling me what they value the most. Right. And what they value is, on foundation, some stability. A good life has some stability to it. It's not precarious. A good life has some boldness to it because we want to learn and grow and lead a psychologically rich life. A good life is a moral life. And a good life is a life of connection and love. And so what we can do when we make decisions today is we can anticipate our future regrets. And we can make, I think, pretty strong predictions about that. You and I, you know, I think the emailer's name was Richard?
Yeah.
Marty, Daniel, and Richard, I can make pretty safe predictions what we're going to care about in 10 years. We're not going to care about whether tonight for dinner we had, you know, meatloaf or turkey tetrazzini. All right. We can try to, it's like, oh, what should I have for dinner? And I want to reduce that regret. All right. It's not going to matter in 10 years. What color car we buy is not going to matter in 10 years. But it's a pretty safe bet that all three of us, if we don't reach out to someone we care about, we'll regret that. If we don't do the right thing, we'll regret that. If we don't take a sensible risk and step up and do something in our limited time on the planet, we're going to regret that. And knowing that can help guide our decisions today to avoid regrets in the future. And what we should do is we should try to avoid these core regrets and actually chill out about everything else.
Here's a comment from Claire, and I can totally connect with you on this. And she says, I still regret screaming at my infant. I scared him so badly, but I was postpartum and so exhausted, but I still feel so horrible about it. It brings me to tears. And Claire, as I think any parent, any caring parent has done this and feels bad about it.
Oh, Claire, you're killing me here because, I'm remembering one terrible regret I had with my son when he was about 4 years old and he was in the back seat and he was screaming. We were trying to go somewhere and my other kids were in the car and he was just screaming. And it was driving me nuts and I told him to be quiet and he wouldn't be quiet. And I finally said, his name is Saul. I said, Saul, if you don't be quiet, I'm just going to take you and put you on the sidewalk and leave. Wow. And so he started screaming even more because he was totally challenging me because he's a smart guy. And to my amazement, to my horror, Marty, telling you this right now, I actually stopped the car, took him out of the car, put him on the sidewalk on Albemarle Street in Washington, D.C. I drove like 10 feet before I was just mortified by myself. But I will never forget that. And now he thinks it's the most hilarious thing now. But for me, it's mortifying because all of us have these lapses. And so what does it tell us? It tells us that chill out a little bit, don't overreact, and treat people with kindness.
And have some self-compassion, right?
Yeah. Believe, you know, again, like Claire and I are not alone in parents who have snapped. Believe me.
Indeed. Here's Celine. I regret not having a relationship with my father. I was estranged from him because of my mother's dementia, and now he's passed away, and it's too late. I mean, again, you know, we're hearing a lot of sad, I mean, painful memories and regrets, Daniel.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's like, so it's interesting. A lot of the regrets that have come in today are these closed door regrets.
Yeah.
But I do think that we can take these closed door regrets and use them to apply going forward, which is what some of the people we've mentioned here. So the woman who had a friend who died of cancer and she didn't get a chance to call her, she completely changed her approach to her other friends. The woman who resented living with having her grandparents visit and because she didn't collect her stories, she affirmatively went and collected stories from her parents. And so for these kinds of regrets, you know, again, treat yourself with some self-compassion, talk about them, and extract a lesson from it. And to me, one of the best ways to extract lessons is with some kind of self-distancing, which is even, you know, what would you tell your best friend to do? That to me is one of the best decision-making tools that we have. As again, we're terrible at solving our own problems, but if you say to people, what would you tell your best friend to do about this? People know almost instantly, and so do that.
Yeah, almost out of time here, but Lynn has a question about career regrets. Mm. And you've done a lot of work about related to the workplace. Anything we should know sort of broadly speaking about career regrets?
One of the big career regrets that people have is not being bold enough, not speaking up, and not being entrepreneurial, and not taking more chances. There are a couple of people who use language like, in my career I was focused more on not failing rather than on succeeding. So that's a big part. The one thing about career regrets, though, is that there are a lot of people who regret not speaking up at work, and that is not entirely on them. A lot of these boldness regrets with careers are messages to organizations to create enough psychological safety so people feel okay about being bold, people feel okay about speaking up, people feel okay about asserting who they are.
Because they want to hear it, they're open to it.
Yeah. You want to, you know, all of us are, you know, all behavior is the interaction of the person and the situation. And so when it comes to the workplace, you're in a particular situation. And so there are people who feel who are blaming themselves for not speaking up at work when all of the blame isn't on them. It could be the culture of their workplace doesn't allow people to speak up, doesn't give people the psychological safety to take risks and so forth. And so a lot of these regrets are also, I think, messages to organizations about, you know, if these are the things that people want out of life, some stability, some boldness, some connection, then why would they not want it out of the half of their waking hours they're spending at work?
Well, Daniel Pink, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure. Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is titled The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks so much for those comments and questions.